Greetings, Raise community. Brent, coming in live with today's guest, Betsy Chapin Taylor, who serves as CEO of Accordant, one of the leading healthcare philanthropy consultancies. Welcome, Betsy.
Hi, Brent. It's great to be with you today.
Well, we got to connect in real life recently at a summit that you hosted, bringing together your team and your client base. And I was so excited coming out of that I wanted to make sure that I could invite you to the Raise podcast as we dive deeper into healthcare philanthropy in this next era of our work here at Evertrue.
Fantastic. I'm thrilled to be here.
Now, we're going to do a little bit of a past, present, future on your entrepreneurial journey, your life journey, really. And so I wanted to start by asking you what we've asked many of our guests, which is take me back to junior year of high school. Who is that Betsy and what led you to Furman University?
Oh, wow. That's a big question. So, you know, I'd say junior year of high school, I was someone who loved the written word, and I loved the power of communication and how it enabled you to connect with other humans. And so at that point, I was torn between, frankly, going into journalism and going into medicine, which seemed very strange, but I was also a nerd. I loved biology. I was in that space. And so at that point, I had no idea I was going to end up where I did now. Fund development had never crossed my mind. Working on the hospital administrative side had never crossed my mind. But as a junior, I knew I loved communication and I was fascinated by the practice of medicine.
And so that led you to what? Did you do pre-med? I mean, where were you thinking as you approached the academic curriculum at Furman?
So I guess I kept a foot in both worlds. I took a biology scholarship to go to Furman, thinking I was going to be pre-med, but then I doubled down on communications and on political science, which was, again, more of the like communication relationship side of things. So I guess I kept my foot in both worlds as long as possible. And then I just reached a point that I really was just loving the journalism side of things. And so I decided to go to graduate school in journalism. And that kind of picked my path. But I got into journalism, and, you know, the world always throws you curveballs. And my mother had actually been really well known for being a great philanthropy leader. And there was a job in my hometown where they were looking for someone to lead a foundation. And I think the truth of it is they really wanted my mother. But they asked me if I would look at the job. And I said, Mom, I don't want to raise money. Like, are you kidding me? Like, why would I ever do that? I want to go and, you know, see the world and do journalism. But I ended up deciding to look at the job, and I went to visit this organization, and I loved them. I loved their mission. I loved their purpose. I loved their intention. And so it was at that point that I realized someone who really wanted to care for the well-being of people and wanted to be a communicator was actually probably born to be a fund development leader.
And so what city was that? And just take me back to kind of year one or two of that job. Sounds like a pretty big job for a pretty early career individual.
It was. So it was Chattanooga, Tennessee, and it was what is now Common Spirit Memorial Hospital. But, you know, this was 30 years ago, and I was young, but I was also tenacious. And I will admit that I cheated a little bit, that on the way to the job interview, I sat down and read the entire book on like designs for fundraising. And so I think I walked in the room able to talk enough about fund development to be dangerous. And I certainly was willing to kind of bring my A game to it. And so they decided to give me an incredible opportunity.
What are some of your most poignant memories from that role, whether it's relationships built or successes, failures? I mean, just what do you think of when you think back on that?
Yeah, you know, I think like what struck me then as intuition then was substantiated later by data that, you know, I kept running into people who were incredibly grateful for their experience. But I also realized that everyone who walks into a hospital is walking in with something heavy. They're walking in with fear. They're walking in hoping that they're going to be given the opportunity to fulfill the dreams they had in mind. And so, you know, that just incredible respect for the values and also the pressures that people walked in the door of a hospital with was incredibly important.
And so were you hooked? Like, did you know at that moment kind of journalism over, although you certainly found ways to bring writing back into your life, but at least as your core professional endeavor, you just sort of pivoted and went all in.
Yeah, I mean, this just was so missional to me. It was so meaningful to me. And I did have the privilege to work in journalism for a short period of time. And, you know, what I found out was journalism in some part is not as glamorous as it sounds like. It's standing on the side of the road at 2 a.m. in the rain, like with an umbrella over your shoulder, waiting for a verdict to come in from a trial. It was not as glamorous as it seemed like. And then I got here and realized this was just very deep purpose work. This was incredibly meaningful to me, and that there was a place for like being a storyteller, being a connector of humans, which brought my love of communications into the room while also doing something that I felt was deeply meaningful.
What was your next stop? Cape Fear? Is that when?
Cape Fear was my next stop.
And so tell me about that, because it sounds like a unique situation in that it's a real operation. Over 700 beds, 5 hospitals in the system, $900 million budget, but no foundation?
There had been a foundation, but it had not been going well. And so they just, I would say it was kind of failure to launch at the time. And so there were a couple of board members who perceived that they should have a fully articulated foundation. And they invited me to come and talk a little bit about what I could do in a leadership role there. And I was really excited about it. It was a large hospital with kind of a blank slate and a vision to do some amazing things. And I perceived that I knew what the pathway could be forward. Now, my mother could have killed me to move to North Carolina because Chattanooga as my hometown meant my whole family was there. And here I was about to launch myself into the ether again. And so I think she was deeply disappointed that I left to go to North Carolina, but it was a great experience for me. And, you know, I think like it's always the time when you say, like, this is an incredible opportunity. I've got to have the guts to get on the bus and go, that you have inflection points in your career. And that was a great inflection point for me.
And so what's interesting is that, you know, as I think about your work now, you're able to get a window into a handful of different organizations, different systems, different maturity levels as you went from there to Hutchinson Medical Center.
Yeah. So, you know, I was saying to one of my colleagues even this morning that, you know, I'm temperamentally well suited to be a consultant. I like getting my hands around a problem, kind of exploring it, figuring out what is there. I'm stripping it back to the bottom and then rebuilding it. And so, you know, learning just additional skills when I was in North Carolina, that positioned me then to go to Hutchinson, where I ended up with both the foundation and the marketing department. And so that was another just kind of interesting expression of how these things two move together. And I think one of the insights that I gained even there is that marketing and philanthropy are so temperamentally different that I think sometimes we think they're the same because they're both external relations functions, but really there's so much that differentiates them from each other that I actually don't think it's necessarily in the best interest of either one of them to bring them together under one consolidated function.
What's an example of the conflict that you've witnessed or experienced personally that has led you to believe that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a couple of things. You know, one, in the world of marketing, results need to be short-term to mid-term. Like if you're not driving volume, if you're not influencing choice, that is important for you to do immediately. But philanthropy, we're on a much longer timeline that could go on years or even decades to reach a transformational level of giving. And so they're just a very different level of accountabilities. I also look at just what success looks like, that in a healthcare organization raising money, we need to maximize total dollars raised, not necessarily close a gift in this moment.
So when you describe leading the foundation and when you describe leading marketing, nothing there would indicate to me that you also are responsible for patient satisfaction. I know that was a big area of your focus at Hutchinson. Just explain to me how you ended up landing on patient satisfaction. What is patient satisfaction? Why does it matter? And then what did you do to move the needle so materially in such a short amount of time?
Wow, you've done a great job of going back and looking at my resume. I think like just that deep understanding that experience was going to be critically important, that organizations that you trust, organizations that you deem worthy of investment, organizations you deem are credible, need to be supported often by a great patient experience, because patients don't know if you did their surgery appropriately, but they do know, were you nice? Were you compassionate? Did you engage them? And so at that period of time, I was really compelled by some of the work that Studer was doing and saw how they were materially moving patient experience scores. And so given that I had both marketing and the foundation, I decided to almost self-appoint myself as the person over patient experience. I was working for a physician CEO at the time, and I went to him and I said, I believe there's a real opportunity here. Nobody here owns this. I would like to own this. I have a vision for it. And he said, fine, go do it. And so we were able to significantly move our percentile rankings in a fairly short period of time. And I felt that lifted philanthropy, it lifted the brand, it lifted our ability to provide great clinical care. And so, that's another dimension of my experience that I'm just glad I've had to be on the front lines of also driving patient experience, which has continued to become more and more important in this space.
I'm sure it's evolved since, but at that time, how was it measured? Was it sort of a survey immediately following care or discharge? I mean, just what was the system?
It was a survey on discharge. And
Yeah.
so, and what's even funnier is it was often a printed USPS mailed survey upon discharge. And
Yeah.
a lot of the questions were around like timeliness, communication, demeanor, and all those things still really matter.
Yeah, look, I think surveys are just so underappreciated. I think sometimes they're leaned on in the philanthropy world for more large scale periodic feedback. But I think that sort of direct response, how was your experience, is actually a big oversight in the fundraising world. I think that, patient experience is measured. Every time we get out of an Uber, we rate our experience, right? Every time we take a flight, we can rate our experience. Every time I give, rarely am I asked to rate my experience, whether that's call it direct response marketing, online giving, or even in an interaction with a fundraiser. And I always find it interesting that we're giving Uber drivers scores for transactional experiences like that, and we would never give a gift officer a score for one of the most meaningful transactions in our lives.
Absolutely. I mean, I know you heard me talk even when we were together in February about we need to start seeing stewardship as a revenue protection strategy. I think many foundations see stewardship as some, sweet nicety that we throw out there. However, the demonstration of thankfulness is critically important. Letting people know what our impact is critically important. And building relationships that are rooted in trust and partnership, great community. Communication, transparency are all critically important. And all of those things are part of the donor care experience. And frankly, I wish we were rated on them. I'm sure there are times that we are a 5 out of 5. And I'm sure there are times that we leave people feeling flat with a 3 out of 5. And it can't be that way. If we're going to build the caliber of relationships that we need to take our organizations into the future, we need to always be thinking with an eye to what did this experience feel like for this donor from their perspective.
Well said, couldn't agree more. Tell me about your move to Erlanger Health System.
Yeah, so that was kind of a crazy, crazy time for me. So I was working at Hutchinson, which was a full 30 minutes away from Erlanger. It was very close. It was in the next county down. But I ended up pregnant with high risk twins. And my high risk twins demanded that I be in a really strong quaternary medical center that had a strong maternal fetal medicine program. And so I end up the philanthropy leader at one hospital as an inpatient at the other hospital.
Wow.
And I was so grateful that this hospital had been thinking about me and my family and preparing for us before I knew that I needed them. So I was in the hospital for 8 weeks. I gave birth to two girls who were born at 32 weekers at 2 pounds apiece. So they were going to go to the neonatal intensive care unit. And by the time I had left the hospital, I was trying to proselytize the people at Erlanger that really I should be running their fund development program. And so shortly after I came back from maternity leave, I ended up leaving and going to Erlanger to lead their philanthropy program.
Now, that's an academic teaching center affiliated with the University of Tennessee Health Science Center College of Medicine. Just tell me about that intersection and how that changed your work, if at all, there.
Yeah. So on one hand, they did have fund development that was coming out of the University of Tennessee as well. But I think that it allowed us to flex some muscles around research, innovation, transformation of healthcare that are just not accessible when you're in a community hospital. Having that academic environment and the rigor that comes with it just meant that the bar was a little bit higher. And we were talking about programs that were more of an N of one than, building another community access point like you're doing in a community hospital.
At what point along the way did you start to get the itch that maybe something entrepreneurial would be in your future?
Yeah, I think like there was an inflection point for me in that I felt that philanthropy was a valuable, low-risk alternative revenue resource. And yet I was talking to a lot of CEOs and other executives who thought that philanthropy was a social endeavor. They thought it was lightweight. They thought it was nice to have. It was being used for kind of the cherry on top instead of for things that were core. And I looked at philanthropy and I just perceived that we were going to have a much larger role going forward than a lot of healthcare executive leadership yet saw or acknowledged. And so there's this crazy Paul Harvey radio show, which, some people on this call are going to be too young to even know who that is. But there's this whole story that Paul Harvey tells about having a snowstorm coming to where he was coming. And he's trying to usher this little bird into a barn to help it get out of the snow. And he said, if only I could talk like a bird. And I thought, sometimes you're right. You've got to come to people with the voice that they understand and in the context that they understand. And so I sat down and wrote a proposal to the American College of Healthcare Executives, which is the largest single professional association for hospital CEOs. And I said, I want to do a class on philanthropy. And I love that they called me and said, we kind of see this as a spinach topic, like ethics, that people probably need it, but they probably don't want it. But they invited me to come and do what they called a development test in Chicago, teaching a group of CEOs about philanthropy. And I went and taught the class, and the class was very well received. And so after that, they invited me to become a part of their faculty, teaching this class on a regular basis. And then they invited me to write a book. And then, I started having people calling me saying, could you come talk to our organization? Could you come give us advice? And so it ended up just becoming something that happened. I'm so incredibly grateful that I got a chance to work on the front line in the field. But then, knowing I was always a writer, I was always a communicator. I always had this sense of incredible restlessness to find problems and solve them. It became a very natural pivot for me to move from being a philanthropy officer to going and starting a consulting firm.
And so what was that specific moment when Accordant was born?
Oh, I think there was no specific moment. I was working as a chief philanthropy officer during the day. And then I was going home at night and sitting on my couch in front of the television, building a logo, building a business, writing business plans, starting to schedule, retreats and other things. And I think almost the luck that I had, which sounds terrible that it was luck, was my organization was going through layoffs. And so I went to the CEO and I said, I want to make an odd proposal. Rather than cutting one of my staff members, what I'd like to propose is that you cut my own hours. And I said, like, you know me, I've never been a 40-hour a week person anyway. I'm a crazy person who worked 60 and 70 hours a week. And so I'm proposing you cut me back to officially working 4 days a week so I can have 1 day off a week to go consult and do other things. But, you know, frankly, I'll do more than you're paying me for. And so they agreed to do that. And that gave me the launching pad to decide to go and spend more time focused on my consulting. And then it reached just a point that it was like, it was clear I needed to jump, that there were great things going on and there was excitement building for me around the prospect of consulting. And so it just reached a natural place where I needed to just go and do consulting full time.
Now, look, there had been plenty of consulting firms prior to that, and there will be many more in the future, but you obviously found a gap in the market and a unique way to package up services, advisory that hadn't been done before. What do you think that gap was, or how would you describe the gap that you saw?
Yeah, I would say there were a ton of firms that were working and helping to raise money. There were no firms in my mind at that point who really understood healthcare. There were firms who were raising money in healthcare, but they were raising money for healthcare and arts organizations and social service organizations and religious organizations. And so in my mind, they knew philanthropy, but they did not deeply understand the business of healthcare. And so I wanted to bring something to the market that deeply understood what it was like to be an executive in healthcare, the pressure points, the unique dynamics. And so that's what I built Accordant around.
What are some of the experiences you're most proud of during your time at Accordant? When you think about specific clients or themes that you feel have really made a difference, that gets you excited, that you share with your team or that your team shares with you, that gets them motivated by your mission?
You know, there's been so much that's been exciting to me. It'd be hard to distill down, but I think there are a few places that we have had the privilege of making our mark. We were talking about strategically aligned project selection before that concept was even cool. You know, we were going to folks and saying, like, you need to deeply align your philanthropy with the strategic vision of potential of your organization. You need to curate down to a short list of things you're going to go raise money for. And that at the time was considered kind of weird. It was considered kind of novel. Now it's what great organizations are doing to make sure that philanthropy is really leveraged to the highest and best use. You know, we also talked differently about how boards should be engaged. I've had the privilege of doing board work for the American Hospital Association and for the Governance Institute and others, just to say, you know, we have this rare and precious commodity in these community leadership volunteers who want to stand up for us and be allies to us, and yet we're often not utilizing them well. So really thinking about how to pivot board work and make it more meaningful has been exciting to me. And then honestly, just getting on the leadership agenda, being able to talk to CEOs about this is not esoteric. This is not a slush fund. This can be a catalytic funding source for you. And so with that, you need to position it properly and resource it appropriately. I love the breakthrough moments that I've had with CEOs who just decided that philanthropy actually deserved to be on the leadership agenda rather than being something that kind of sat over there out of the way, out of sight, out of mind.
It's really interesting because, you know, like you, I have sort of grown up in this industry of philanthropy, and you forget that for the ultimate CEO of any of these organizations, whether it's healthcare or higher education, arts and cultural, that philanthropy is just a sliver of their time and attention, because it's all thinking about all day, every day. And what if you did this? And what if you did that? And what if you did, you know, made this change? And it's like, they have so much on their plates. How do you help them really understand that this warrants a spot on their prioritized short list of key issues?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think with that, Brent, one of the problems that we had was leaders were looking at philanthropy and operating dollars gross to gross. And so while the healthcare organization, it was costing them often 98 cents to earn a dollar, they didn't realize that the philanthropy organization was costing them 25 cents to earn a dollar. And so if you happen to look at operating revenue and philanthropy revenue net to net instead of gross to gross, many organizations realized that it was often like the second revenue driver for their organization. And I think just recalibrating the way we looked at philanthropy became a game changer for many organizations to realize they needed to position it and fund it more appropriately.
So somebody would just think, hey, we're doing $100 million in revenue and patient revenue over here. We're only doing $10 million in philanthropy. I got to focus on the 100. Your argument is, yeah, but the $10 million is way more profitable than your entire $100 million of patient revenue.
Absolutely. And I think like literally no one had done the math in many of the organizations I went into to realize that very simple fact.
Interesting. And so as you think about the scope of your work today, the firm's work, what is the ideal, you know, because you have client, prospective client engagements the same way that we do. And sometimes you just know, wow, there's a great fit here. I can just feel that what we do best is where they're really at right now, what they need. What does that look like today if I were, you know, interviewing some of your consultants, for example?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a few things that clearly go in the value chain for me. First and foremost, you've got to figure what you're going to raise money for that is strategic. Too many organizations are still kind of making stuff up to raise money for instead of articulating the highest and best use of philanthropy. If you know what your projects are, then you have better line of sight to who your donors are going to be. And so once you know who those likely populations are going to be, then harnessing the power of business intelligence, data, and analytics to further refine who those prospective partners are is important. At the same time, using that information to start to figure out who your clinician partners are going to be. That we don't need in most organizations to involve a large number of clinicians. We need to be very strategically focused on those who are best positioned to be allies and advocates. And so I think you've just got to start looking at where the value chains are. And then certainly as stakeholders, we need executive leadership to come alongside us to articulate the value of philanthropy and why the organization is worthy of being chosen as a partner. So, you know, over and over again, we're focusing on project selection, on identifying the right donors, on clinician engagement. And then I think you got to have also another realistic look at the world that is also rooted in your database. All donors are not created equally. And so while there is a place for all people to participate, for most organizations, we're seeing that 1 to 5% of their donors are driving 80% of their dollars. If you do not have a focus on leadership and principal gifts, you are not being a great steward of your resources. And so again, having that clarity around if we're going to optimize total dollars, who do we need to be talking to? And it's not about the big tent, it's about the small table.
Have you seen examples where the before and after is that compelling, where somebody just didn't really fully appreciate the potential around principle and leadership giving, they invested in it, and they really were maybe themselves surprised by the outcomes?
I've got a client I'm working with right now that I think has seen the value of focusing on the fundamentals.
Yeah.
This is an organization that we, over the course of a few years, we saw an increase of like 22% from year one to year two. We saw an increase of another 26% between that year and the next year. And this year, this organization is going to see another increase that is in the range of 30%. Wow. And so you think about over the period of just a few years, they will double their philanthropic revenue. And it, to me, was about nothing that was Sexy. It was about leaning in around the fundamentals, great projects, great use of data, the right donors at leadership and principal gift levels, and the right clinician partners. And I think, like, if you just pay attention to those fundamentals, that's what gets you where you need to go. And if I were to add another to the list, it is great stewardship, because the reality is, it is so much more inefficient to acquire. We need to focus on retain.
Yeah. Look, I think your comments around data obviously resonate with our work and what we're focused on. And even your point just around 1-5% of people generating 80% of the revenue, we see that as well. And so, of course, the question is, who are that 1-5%? How can I predict who that 1-5% might be? And unlike maybe universities or other verticals where they sort of have a lifetime to get there with a donor, like you said, people walk through the door. It's a heavy moment. It's emotional. They have a great patient experience. You got to follow up quickly. And I think that's part of the opportunity and the challenge is there is such a velocity, a volume of patient data that, right, being able to filter through it quickly, identify the highest potential, individuals, and then make sure that there's timely follow-up is a key part of this.
Absolutely. And the velocity of healthcare. I love that you pulled that out. That is so true. Like, you do have these long longitudinal relationships, particularly in an academic environment. But the reality is that in healthcare, you can wake up on a Monday and care nothing about a hospital, nothing about healthcare. You go to the doctor on Tuesday and they say, you have cancer. You now care greatly about healthcare and making sure you've got excellent clinical quality, a great clinical experience and access right close to home. And so your depth of commitment to a hospital can go from 0 to 100 in a matter of days. And we've also got to realize, though, that people are anxious to get back to their lives. So once you've had that intervention, that surgery, that chemo, that radiation, whatever it may be, you want to put it behind you and move on and get back to your life. And so if you've not moved with a degree of alacrity, you can miss that whole window in which people are interested and inclined to give to your organization.
I love it. Betsy, as we start to wrap up today, take me back full circle now to future journalist Betsy, and tell me about your experience as present author Betsy. You've published several books. I'm a future author, I hope, but what advice would you have, or just as you reflect on balancing that process in addition to your day job and parenting and everything else you've shared? Worth it? I mean, not worth it. Like, just tell me more.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, like, for me, like, Brent, writing is a passion project. It's not work to me. It's an expression of the things I believe in and care about and that I'm moved and motivated by. So I have, like, I've written or edited a few books. I've written tons of articles for many of our big trade associations. That's my passion project. And I hope I've got at least a few more books in me. At some point, I'm going to slow down enough that I actually create the time to write them. But right now, I get up every day excited about the things that I have to do today, and I don't always make the space to let myself write. But that is certainly where my passion is, and hopefully that's something I could do to add some value to the field somewhere.
So looking forward, 2026, 2027, what's top of mind? What are you hearing about in the boardrooms, on the CEO agenda? Just what are the themes, whether it has anything to do with fundraising or not?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're seeing board members particularly want a more meaningful experience. We need to move with much more agility in creating, designing experiences for them to be involved, and frankly, in fostering that most important work. Why would you pull influential community leadership volunteers around your table and then not ask them to be part of leadership and principal giving? We need to focus that work. I think many organizations, while I've said strategically aligned project selection is critically important, a lot of organizations are really horrible at doing that. They cannot articulate what their vision of potential is. And that is going to be just a fundamental capability that I think organizations need to refine. And then this whole idea of focusing on principal gifts. There are folks who are squeamish about it. they think that maybe that leaves people out, leaves people behind. However, I think as stewards of our organization and our mission, we have an obligation to figure out those who are best positioned to invest in our organizations at a transformational level. So there's always a place for all to give, but I think that our time and resources need to be directed toward leadership and principal giving.
So is that a way of saying, I mean, I'll ask you, you know, bluntly, that we're spending too much time on the mass marketing?
I think we are. And I think we also, you know, one of the things I push on in healthcare all the time is 20 and 30 year old donors are charming. They are lovely. They are delightful. They are not our focus area. Like organizations that are, frankly, I think, wasting their time building young donor and young professionals programs. The reality is in healthcare that the typical donor is a 65 year old woman. She's a woman who's seen her parents go through healthcare. She's now starting to experience acute needs for healthcare. And she's got children that she wants to make sure have healthcare. I think we need to let our lovely 20 and 30 year old donors who've only had the experience of delivering a baby cut their teeth on philanthropy elsewhere, like arts or organizations, environmental organizations, you know, let them cut their teeth elsewhere and then come back to us. If we're going to be successful, we got to have focus. Like strategy is focus. Strategy is saying no to things. Strategy is frankly leaning into the value of having constraints. We need to be smarter about our work instead of trying to be everything to everybody.
I think that's really well said. And, you know, look, we deal with universities a lot, which they greatly struggle with this. You know, number one thing you hear in business is you can't be all things to all people, or, you know, choose your ideal customer profile, focus, focus, focus. And I think many organizations get pulled into, yeah, but the right thing to do, or I want to include everyone. I have to have something for everyone. And it really comes at the expense of what you just described, which is there's massive missed opportunity in the 60 to 70 year old cohort. And if we only focused our limited time and attention there, created amazing stewardship experiences there, and had intentional principal giving focus there, we would just raise more money. And yes, it would come at the expense of the young donor advisory council or whatever it may be. And I think many nonprofit leaders struggle with that balance of like inclusivity versus radical focus.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, last theme I wanted to just cover is mentorship often serves surfaces on this podcast. And I just wanted to ask you if you've had mentors that you'd want to give a shout out to or who've been influential to you along your professional and personal journey.
Oh, I have had the privilege of so many amazing mentors. I could not call out one. It's like the Academy Awards. I can't call out one without calling out 50. But I do think there's huge value in having a mentor and being a mentor. And part of what I think mentors need to do for you is be blunt in pushing you, telling you the truth, encouraging you to take risk, encouraging you to take a broader vision of what your own potential and capacity is. And there's a lot of value to having a mentor who will give you tough love and who will push you harder.
Well, I know you've motivated and inspired a lot of people, Betsy, and I'm grateful for you sharing your journey with our audience here today.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Brent. Great to be with you today.
All right. With that, Brent, closing today's episode with Betsy Chapin Taylor, who serves as CEO of Accordant. Good day.